There we are. All right. So one of the things that was really good for me about this, putting together this talk, is trying to get a complete picture of what happened with the trial and crucifixion of Jesus. And I mean, I had an appreciation for how much you sort of need to look at all four of the gospels at the same time. But I really didn't appreciate how different the four gospels treat these topics. And apparently that's how God intended it. Okay? If you know, the Holy Spirit inspired all of the Bible, then it wasn't a mistake that there were four accounts that, when put together, sort of give you the whole picture. And I think not only is it God's intent that that happens with, you know, the trial of Jesus, the crucifixion, the life of Jesus, but really that's how it is with the entire Word of God. And we've talked about that before, that you really need to read the whole Bible to get a clear message of what God is trying to tell us. We were talking about it just last week. You can't pick out just one verse here or there to support some notion that you already has decided what you want to believe and then draw conclusions based on those isolated verses. And even if those verses might seem to be the only place in the Bible that a certain topic is addressed, there are still other principles and truths throughout the Bible that need to be taken into account. So what I'm going to do today is a little bit more in the text than maybe has been done in the past by some of the guys. I mean, there's a ton of material here. And I was trying to come up with something, you know, unique to present, and there isn't anything unique about it. I mean, these are stories that we've probably been reading since we were kids. We're very familiar with them. You know, we've heard Boku sermons and whatnot on them. And so I think what I'll do is just start out reading and then make a couple of comments as we go along. So I'm gonna before I actually get into the text of Luke 23, I'm just gonna backtrack a little bit and bring in some verses from some of the other Bibles that just sort of set the stage for where Luke 23 begins. So in Matthew 26, starting in verse 7, it says, and we're in the Garden of Gethsemane now. While he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. With him was a large crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them: "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. Jesus replied, "Do what you came for, friend." And it's interesting when you read the accounts of what took place between Judas and Jesus in the other three gospels. None of them are exactly the same. I think only two of the four mention that Judas actually kisses Jesus. And in one of the gospels, maybe it was John, there's no exchange between Judas and Jesus whatsoever. And it's almost like Jesus just takes Judas out of the picture, and it says Jesus knew what everyone was coming for, and he walked up to the crowd and addressed them. And Judas just isn't in the picture. But again, you can't, you know, read one gospel and say, well, here's a contradiction, because, you know, maybe Judas wasn't there because this gospel doesn't mention him. No, it's just like you could read four different biographies of Abraham Lincoln. Every one of the biographies would be different. Some would say some things, others would say other things. Some topics would be covered by all of them. It doesn't mean that anything is wrong or inaccurate with any of the accounts, as long as there isn't a direct contradiction, and something being missing in one and said in another is not a contradiction. So continuing on then, in verse 50, then the men stepped forward, seized Jesus, and arrested him. With that, one of Jesus's companions reached for his sword, drew it out, and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Now, this is pretty interesting because, you know, you notice here that in Matthew's gospel, it doesn't mention who the disciple was who cut off the ear. And were it not for John, we wouldn't know, because none of the other three gospels mention that it was Peter. It's only John's gospel that mentions that it was Peter. You can only speculate why that might be. One of the things that I've read with some commentators that I've noticed from reading the Gospels and even in the current Chosen series, there is a theme in there that John and Peter were not really that great of friends, or let's put it this way, they were very competitive with each other. And you can see that in the way John talks about things, you know, when Peter ran for the tomb, you know, in John's gospel, John talks about, you know, he ran past Peter and got there first. And so there's this competitive thing going on. Maybe John is trying to get a dig in on Peter and point out that he's kind of a loose cannon. One of the interesting things about the inspiration of the Bible by the scripture, this is a little, just a side little rabbit trail. God doesn't say anywhere in the Bible how much latitude he's given the writers of the books of the Bible. Okay. And again, some people say, well, so-and-so didn't write the book, you know, the book of John. It wasn't John. It was the Holy Spirit who wrote it. And I get the sense in which someone says that, but nonetheless, John was the one who put, you know, pen to paper, so to speak. And we do know from reading the whole Bible, and especially Paul's letters, there's a different way that Paul has of speaking in writing his letters than, say, Luke does, or than Peter does. And that indicates that God has allowed something of the style, personality, whatever you want to call it, to come through in the writings. And so apparently John's little braggadocio at times, or digs on Peter, God has allowed to come through. Maybe he wanted John to put these digs in there and caused him to put it in there. We don't know that for sure, but I think that there definitely is some use of the native talents of the writers that comes through. So in verse 52, going back, put your sword back in its place, Jesus said, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Here again, this is an example of something we talked about before, about a little bit of hyperbole. Does everyone who draws a sword get killed by a sword? No, but it's a principle that he's putting forward. Verse 53, do you think I cannot call on my Father? He will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels. But how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen this way? And that's something that Jesus says a couple of times in the various gospels, that he said, it has to happen the way it is happening because that's how scripture predicted it would happen. Which some people have criticized, saying that, you know, Jesus sort of scripted the whole thing and none of it was natural, which we know isn't true. He's God, so he knew how it would happen. That's different from necessarily scripting how it was going to happen. But back to verse 55, in that hour, Jesus said to the crowd, this is the crowd who came to arrest him in the garden, I am leading a rebellion, or am I leading rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I sat in the temple courts teaching, and you did not arrest me. But this all has taken place again, that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all the disciples deserted him and fled. And this is where there's a very interesting two verses that are then inserted after this point of the disciples deserted him and fled, but only in the Gospel of Mark. And in Mark, this is in chapter 14, verses 51 and 52, which come immediately after this, then all the disciples deserted him and fled. And they say, a young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. And that's just it. And based on that, almost every gospel commentator, Bible commentator, believes that it was in fact Mark who wrote this, who was the person who had his garment ripped off and fled naked. You ask yourself, why are these two verses in here? Do we really need to know this information? And, you know, we can take that up with the Lord when we see him. I'm going to flip over, continuing on just a little bit in John. It says that then the detachment of the soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people. Now, this is also very interesting. It is only in John's gospel that it mentions the hearing before Annas occurring prior to the hearing before Caiaphas. And so this kind of lets us know then, and I had never thought about this before prepping for this talk, but there were actually six hearings or trials, if you will, that Jesus went through prior to his execution. There was this hearing before Annas, who was the previous high priest before Caiaphas, and it's sort of like Rome appointed who the high priest was. But under Jewish law, once you were the high priest, you were the high priest forever. So it's sort of like being a professor and stopping teaching, but you're still a professor emeritus or a professor retired. So Caiaphas still had, or Annas still had, this very high status in the Sanhedrin, even though he wasn't actually the high priest at this time and his son-in-law Caiaphas was. So the six hearings, one before Annas, one before Caiaphas. Then there's the one that's coming up before the entire Sanhedrin. Then there was the first trial in front of Pilate. Then Pilate sent him to Herod. Then there was the second trial in front of Pilate after Herod came back. And despite the fact that there were six trials of Jesus by allegedly men of God, well, I guess Pilate and Herod wouldn't be, but nonetheless, he didn't get a fair trial in any of those six instances. So then I'm going to go to continuing on in John in verse 15. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard, but Peter had to wait outside the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. What I just read is only in John's gospel. None of the other gospels mention that there was another disciple there with Peter. In fact, I'm not really sure I was aware that the courtyard, again, previously aware, that the courtyard where Peter was taken, did the denials, was the courtyard right outside of the high priest's house, where Jesus was inside being tried. But that's where Peter was. So you have this verse in one of the Gospels, or in several of them, that say all the disciples abandoned Jesus and fled. And at the same time, you have Peter actually kind of following behind Jesus. So he was seeing where they took Jesus after he was arrested. And then you have John here indicating that he was with Peter. He doesn't refer to himself by his own name, which other places John doesn't as well. He refers to himself a lot of times as the disciple that Jesus loved. So here John is just saying another disciple. But again, all the commentators are, you know, pretty certain that this is John who is with Peter. And they're right outside of where the trial is happening. And in fact, it looks like maybe John, because he was known to the high priest, was perhaps inside while the trial was going on. And maybe that's how we get some of the information about exactly what was said, because John was actually on the inside. So now I'm going to switch over to Luke, just a couple verses before chapter 23 starts. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together with Jesus, and Jesus was led before them. So this is daybreak. The entire Sanhedrin is meeting now, the council of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law. And notice this is at daybreak. Jesus has already been to Annas's house and the trial there. He's already been to Caiaphas's house and had a trial there. And now at daybreak, he's in front of the entire Sanhedrin. He was arrested in the middle of the night in the Garden of Gethsemane. Remember, everyone couldn't stay awake. It was the end of the day, and so they were all falling asleep. So what you can tell from that is that Jesus didn't sleep that night at all. He went from wherever he was to the garden, got arrested, and was up the entire night being interrogated. And here we find him at daybreak in front of the Sanhedrin. And so that they asked him, are you the Messiah? Tell us. Jesus answered, if I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I asked you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. Which again is the infamous way, very famous way that Jesus has of answering questions, not the way that we would think, are you the Messiah? And he says, from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. And you look at that and you sort of go, what? But so then it says in verse 70, they all asked, are you the Son of God? He replied, you say that I am. Again, Jesus's way of answering. Then they said, why do we need any more testimony? We have heard it from his own lips. So that gets us right up to where chapter 23 starts. So you can tell he's had three trials here, and it's sort of at this point, guilty, guilty, guilty. And there were some other verses, I think, previous to Gethsemane that talked about the Sanhedrin meeting and deciding at that point already that he was guilty before any kind of a trial, which all the commentators are quick to point out violates all of the laws that were in place, the Jewish laws that were in place about trials and witnesses and not being forced to incriminate yourself and everything. All that was just thrown out the window, because they already knew the answer that they wanted and they just simply said, this is the answer, whether it was true or not. So in verse 20 and 23, verse 1 in Luke, then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, we have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be a Messiah, a king. Interesting that they mention that he opposes payment of taxes to Caesar. All the Jews oppose payment of taxes to Caesar, but now they want to hang Jesus for that. Verse 3, so Pilate asked, are you the king of the Jews? You have said so. Jesus replied, we've heard that before. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowd, I find no basis for a charge against this man. Obviously, more happened than just that one question. In this gospel, we don't know what that is. I'm not sure any of the gospels give us all of the information. As I think we've discussed before, Pilate and Herod, because of how powerful they were, all had their spies, and they sort of knew what was going on with Jesus. And they knew that the charges that the Jews were bringing to them were sort of trumped up charges. And that's why Pilate is able to make this statement, one of the very true things that Pilate said, I find no basis for a charge against this man. But they insisted, the Jews and the crowd, he stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and come all the way here. On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, which included Galilee, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform a sign of some sort or a miracle. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked Jesus. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. So this is sort of a Sun Tzu type of thing. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people and said to them, you brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. So a second trial before Pilate, a second time, he comes to the conclusion that there's no basis for the charges. Neither has Herod. So apparently when Jesus came back, word came back with him. Herod didn't find any basis for charges. He has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him. So it doesn't say what the reason is that he's punishing. He thinks he should punish Jesus. Maybe he's just saying, okay, I'll punish him and release him just to appease the Jews, but it didn't actually work. And at this point, that was verse 16, I'll punish him and then release him. I found out something again that despite 30, 40 years of reading the Bible, I didn't know before. In Bible Gateway, you're all familiar with that, the Bible software, there's 67 English translations of the Bible in Bible Gateway. 33 of them, including the NIV, do not have a verse 17, though they usually do have a footnote saying that some manuscripts have a text similar to Matthew 27:15 or Mark 15:6, dealing with the tradition of releasing a prisoner near Passover. But apparently not enough manuscripts or not authoritative enough manuscripts that the publishers of those 33 English versions of the Bible, again, including the NIV, felt that it was the most credible that this verse 17 existed. And so I don't know which Bibles you're reading. You can take a look at them either now or some other time. But you may just see, if you have one of those 33 versions of the Bible, that there is no verse 17. Okay, then moving to verse 18, but the whole crowd shouted, "Away with this man, release Barabbas to us." Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed them again, but they kept shouting, "Crucify him, crucify him." For the third time, he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has this man committed? I have found no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him." But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. So not in Luke's version here, but in one of the other versions, it has the kind of famous line of Pilate's, "I wash my hands of Jesus." But again, not in this version. As the soldiers led him away, they seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, and put the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. There's some things that I read about the cross and carrying the cross that I did not previously know. And I'd copied a whole bunch of material to read about it, but we're not going to have time. So I'm just going to mention this briefly in summary. The cross that was carried by Jesus and by other people who were paraded through the town was likely not the entire cross. It was only the horizontal piece of the cross. Most of the the material that I read said that the entire cross with the vertical piece and the horizontal piece probably would have weighed over 300 pounds. Most of the time, where the people were going to be crucified, especially if there were lots of crucifixions, there were permanent horizontal pieces fixed in the ground. And what each individual criminal carried was vertical pieces fixed in the ground. What each criminal carried was the horizontal piece that they were attached to. And so it's likely that that's what Jesus carried. Now, that piece, they said, still would have weighed probably 60 to 100 pounds on its own. So it wasn't that it was light. But all the pictures that you always see drawn, or Stations of the Cross or whatever it happens to be, where it shows, you know, Jesus with this entire cross with both pieces slung over him and carrying that along, probably wasn't accurate. But again, it was referred to as a cross, and so that's what was painted in all these pictures. Another thing about the cross is that we get this idea that Jesus was high up on the cross. And most of the commentaries that I read said that no, that wasn't really the case. There's some wording that maybe sort of indicated that, but from archaeological things they've found, the people who were hung on the cross were much lower to the ground. So, you know, they were put up sort of only as high as they needed to be put up to have their feet come off of the ground. And in terms of the, let me just jump over here to another thing I have. In terms of the shape of the cross, so we mentioned the two pieces. It's interesting, the word crucifixion really, the root of the word refers to the display of the body on the crucifix more so than the killing of the person. So throughout the years, crucifixion has been used by not only the Romans, but many societies, both before and after the time of Jesus. And the sometimes people would be displayed on a cross even after they were killed in another manner. And the reason that that was done, and it's partially the reason that Jesus suffered the way he did and was crucified, was to simply discourage people from disobeying the law by hanging the body on a cross for public display. So whether the death occurred on the cross or whether it occurred before the person went to the cross, crucifixion, that term, would still refer to that body being displayed. Now, Jesus died on the cross. There doesn't seem to be any dispute, at least among the Gospels or among Christians, that happened, but it isn't always the case. And as far as the shape of the cross that Jesus was on, we don't know for sure. There were crosses that were the traditional way we think of looking at a cross, which is two pieces of wood with the vertical piece extending above where the horizontal piece is. That seems to not be the most common way that crosses were, although some were like that. I mean, the ones that you see in churches, it looks like someone, you know, took great pains to create this kind of, I don't know if it's called a mortise joint or whatever it is, but where the front and the back combine and you hollow out each one and they fit together and everything is smooth and perfect. Probably not the way that it happened. They certainly weren't going to go through that bother just to kill someone on the cross or to display a dead body. And so there's actually a name for a cross, and in Latin it's called cruce simplex, and it is simply one vertical stake without even a cross member, and people could still be crucified on that, whether that's killed on it or displayed on it, and you would simply pull their hands up above their heads and affix them onto the one vertical piece and affix their feet at the bottom on the one vertical piece. And you wouldn't need to have their arms splayed out to the side necessarily. And that's the cross, the crux simplex. The normal T shape. Not the normal T shape. The normal cross shape has a different Latin word. There's also another type of a cross, which many people think was the most common, and that was simply the cross was in the shape of a T, and so the cross member was just placed at the top of the vertical piece. And that would be the piece that they had to drag up through the town, and that was placed on top of the vertical piece. But there were many different shapes of crosses. Some Seneca the Younger guy from just after the time of Jesus is recorded as having said, "I see crosses not just of one kind, but in many different ways. Some have their victims with head down to the ground. Some impale their private parts. Others stretch their arms out on the gibbet." And so two things that you may have heard of, the cross of St. Peter, and this would be a cross that's displayed, even if it's just on a page with different shapes of crosses for informational purposes. This is where the vertical piece is long from the top down, and the cross piece happens, you know, just up from the bottom of the cross. And it's called, obviously, the cross of St. Peter, because tradition has it that Peter was crucified upside down, although it appears that he wasn't the only person who was ever crucified that way, that other people, whether they requested it or not, were sometimes crucified upside down. And then another common shape of a cross is simply an X, where the two timbers are crossed like an X. And this is sometimes when you see a cross just drawn and displayed this way, again with other crosses, it's called the St. Andrew's cross, because traditionally Peter's brother Andrew is said to have been crucified on an X-shaped cross. So anyway, that's more about crosses, nails, just, well, briefly on nails. The Greek word apparently for putting the cross through the hand is a word that would encompass anything from the fingertips up to the elbow. So a lot of commentators say that we don't know for sure where the nails went through Jesus's hands, even though he says to Thomas, here, put your finger in my hands. But again, it's that word, that Greek word that, you know, means that whole sort of section of the arm. Most people probably weren't, didn't have the nails go directly through the center of the palm, because there wasn't enough strength there if they weren't also tied on with ropes to support a body. The hand would just rip out from the weight of the body. And so a more likely spot, they say, is just above the wrist on the forearm side, because you've got the radius and the ulna, or the two bones of the forearm, and there's a spot in there where you could get a nail through. But yet those bigger bones of the hand would likely not give way and might support the body. Another thing that I wasn't aware of is that crosses typically had a footrest on them. So just a kind of a triangular piece there at the bottom that the feet would go on, and then they would sometimes be nailed into that triangular piece. And from archaeological digs, they found, I think, just a couple of instances, because there haven't been many found at all, but where there was actually a seat put on the cross. And you might think, well, footrest and a seat, that would make the person more comfortable. Why would they do that? And the reason they did that was not to make the person more comfortable, but it was because sometimes they wanted the body to hang up there for a long period of time, so to make more of an impression on the population, and to make the person suffer in agony for a longer period of time. And without a footrest or a seat rest, the weight of the body would often cause the person on the cross to die from asphyxiation, you know, maybe within a matter of minutes, to, you know, 10, 15 minutes or whatever. They couldn't live. And so to prolong the agony, they would very often have a seat that would support the butt, and the seat for the feet, which also helps to keep the body from ripping out of however they restrained it on the cross. Enough of those details. Back to the text of Luke 23, just to wrap up here. Let's see, I'm going to jump down to, So right after we left off in verse 26 with Simon the Cyrene being asked to help Jesus carry the cross. And in verse 27, it says a large number of people followed him, including women who had mourned and wailed for him. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the childless women, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if people do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry?" And that last verse there seems sort of strange. I really haven't focused in on that verse before much. And read up a little bit about it, and a lot of commentaries say no one's really sure exactly what this means, but one that I read said, if Pilate could thus sentence to death one in whom he acknowledged that he could find no fault, what might be expected from Pilate's successors when they had to deal with a rebellious and guilty people? And so here, the green tree would be Jesus or a person who is innocent. So if this is what happens, if what happened to Jesus is what happens to someone who is innocent, what's going to happen to people who are guilty? Or at least who people who Rome or the authorities in power at whatever time throughout the centuries, is what some people believe is what Jesus is alluding to here. Continuing on in verse 32, two other men, both criminals, were also led out to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there along with the criminals, one on his right, one on his left. Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they did not know what they are doing. And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. People stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, he saved others, but let him save himself if he is God's Messiah, the chosen one. The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, if you're the king of the Jews, save yourself. There was written notice above him, which read, this is the king of the Jews. One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us. Matthew and Mark each state that, so this is Luke. Luke doesn't state this. John doesn't state it. But Matthew and Mark each state that both criminals hurled insults at Jesus initially, and that later the one criminal rebuked the other criminal. So, even though that distinction isn't made in Luke, again, why you need to read all the Gospels. Apparently, at the beginning, when the criminal that Jesus, said he was going to be in paradise with him, when he was first there hanging on the cross next to Jesus, he was dissing Jesus, just like the other guy was. And then he apparently had a change of heart. But the other criminal rebuked him. Don't you fear God? He said, since you're under the same sentence, we are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong. Then he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Jesus answered him, truly I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise. There's lots of people who have lots of different things to say about the thief on the cross. Virtually nothing is known about the thief on the cross. Apparently, God didn't find it important that we know anything about the thief on the cross other than what's said. Some people refer to the fact that the thief on the cross repented from the words that the thief on the cross said. There's no indication that he repented. However, we don't, I think, really need an indication that he repented in his own words. Here's what I'm sticking with. Jesus said, truly I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise. And if Jesus says that to someone, that's what's going to happen. We know that only God knows what's in a person's heart. And so whether the thief said more than this and it simply wasn't recorded, or whether this is all he said, Jesus was able to look into his heart and was able to tell what was in his heart and save him on that basis. And my personal opinion is that this is why it's a little bit dicey for us ever to make a judgment about someone is saved or not saved, one way or the other. God knows what's in the person's heart. And if that person hasn't outwardly ticked all the boxes, checked all the boxes that we think, that some Christians think that need to be checked in order for a person to be saved. They think that then they're not going to be saved. This is prima facie evidence that that isn't the case, because this thief, from everything that God wanted us to know about him, doesn't check hardly any boxes. And yet he's saved. And there's no doubt that he's saved, because Jesus said that he's saved. So we got started late, and obviously I'm over, but so the good news, the rest of the men aren't having to suffer through that, just my guys from my little group here. And I think I'm going to leave it at that. That's, you know, after this, there isn't much said in the next paragraph. Jesus dies, and then there's the burial. You can read about the burial on your own. And I think we'll probably bring it to a close here. So, very good. Thanks.
Thanks, bro.